April is National Poetry Month, and this morning is our annual Poetry Sunday, in which we explore the life and legacy of a particular poet. Although individual poems can, of course, be deeply meaningful without knowing anything about a poet's life, learning more about a poet's background can make a poet's work even more deeply resonant. In recent years, we've focused on Elizabeth
Bishop, Gwendolyn Brooks, Mary Oliver, Emily Dickinson, Sylvia Plath, Audrey Rich. And in the future, I look forward to sharing with you about other major poets, including Szilo Miloš, Denise Levertov, Audre Lorde, and more. Before we turn to our focal poet, I wanted to briefly share two notes about poetry more generally. First, I encourage you to keep your eyes out for any opportunities featuring Ada Limón, our current U.S. poet laureate. She's a profound poet in her own right, that we've featured her poetry a number of times over the years in Sunday services, as well as a powerful advocate for poetry in the public square. Anything you might see about her during National Poetry Month or throughout the year, really, is something very much worth engaging with and paying attention to. As she said in her standing room only inaugural address at the Library of Congress, tonight is about everyone who risks making art in a world that often deems art unnecessary or worse, frivolous. I was lucky enough, she said, to be raised by people who supported my creative life. My mom's paintings, they grace the cover of every book I've ever published. And my stepdad has been making me a better writer since I was 10 years old. To me, a major takeaway from that quote is the challenge for us to seek out ways both to cultivate creativity in ourselves as well as to inspire and encourage creativity in art, in poetry, in those of us in our others in our lives, as well as anywhere in our spheres of influence. As the poet William Carlos Williams similarly wrote, "It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet many die miserably every day for lack of what is found there." For many people, art is not optional. It is essential for the life well lived. And for today, I'd like to invite us to explore the life and legacy of John Donne. I was inspired to focus on Donne by a new biography about him that the New York Times named as one of their top 100 books of 2022. Have any of you read Super Infinite? All right, I don't see any hands. It's really, as biographies are often like this thick, this is actually a very short and accessible and really, really interesting and well-read, well-written book. So it's titled Super Infinite, The Transformations of John Donne by Catherine Rundle, who was a fellow of All Souls College in Oxford, which didn't you know like what you have to do to be a fellow of All Souls College? It's like ridiculous. You can like look into it later. She's obviously like wildly intelligent because it's a very elite institution. So Donne has been hailed as arguably the greatest metaphysical poet in the English language and a master of meditative prose. Slightly less charitably, one of his contemporaries, who was perhaps jealous, described Donne as a great visitor of ladies, a great frequenter of plays, and a great writer of conceited verse. Now, closer to our own time, a 20th century literary critic wrote about the experience of wading through this book, the Oxford Book of 17th Century Verse. Anyone read that one? I have very much. Oh, you have. Great. Let's talk later. All right. It's a tome that weighs in at around 1,000 pages. And so this critic talks about encountering, you know, many interesting, of course, interesting and respected poems, but he found himself coming to rapt attention and feeling blown away when he stumbled upon the opening stanza to Donne's poem, The Good Morrow. "I wonder, by my troth, what thou and I did till we loved. Were we not weaned till then, but sucked on country pleasures childishly? Or snorted we in seven sleepers' den? 'Twas so, but this all pleasures' fancies be. If ever any beauty I did see, which I desired and got, 'twas but a dream of thee." Donne knew how to write some sexy talk. So, Similarly, Virginia Woolf wrote in praise of Donne that the typical Elizabethan wrote with his love of eloquence, with his longing for brave new words, and tended to enlarge and to generalize. Donne's genius in this era was precisely the opposite of this. He particularized, kind of like Mary Oliver, you know, writing about in a very particular way. Woolf continued, "It is this desire for nakedness in an age that was florid, this determination to record not the likenesses which record a rounded and seemly whole, but to underscore the inconsistencies that break up semblances, the power to make us feel the different emotions of love and hate and laughter at the same time. That is what separates Donne from his contemporaries." Turns out Woolf can write as well. His contemporaries tended to conform to forms and rhyme schemes inherited from the classical greats and from European traditions of courtly verse. Donne, in contrast, possessed a unique voice and was willing to engage with a free, flowing style. And as you have already heard in that first poem I read a few minutes earlier, he wasn't afraid to get a little or a lot flirty and licentious. Donne felt deeply that the fullness of reality, it transcends the capacities of human language, which is also part of what compelled him to invent new words and to experiment with new poetic forms. He accounts for the first recorded use in the Oxford English Dictionary of around 340 words in the English language, including apprehensible, beauteousness, emancipation, and that's a good one, enripen, fecundant, horridness, embrothelled, and jig. In the words of his biographer, language to Donne is a set not of rules, but of possibilities. Despite how legendary Donne has become, we only have one surviving poem in his handwriting. It's titled To the Lady Carew. Of course it is. I'll zoom in to give you a closer look. His handwriting is typically described as beautiful, the italic hand of a court-trained man with elaborately swooping Y's. Although Donne knew he was prodigiously talented as a writer, and even though he was personally ambitious, he doesn't seem to have had a sense that his poems in particular would have a would be of interest to posterity, much less that almost 400 years after his death, you would be able to buy coffee mugs and T-shirts emblazoned with his visage and the slogan, "Let's get metaphysical." The only reason we have copies of Donne's poems today is that they were folded into small squares and passed from hand to hand and posted between friends of friends and friends and read and passed on. Today, we'd say his poems went viral. There are more than 4,000 copies of his individual poems and 260 manuscripts, and it's extremely likely there are more out there in archives and private collections waiting for us to discover them. Without having any way of knowing it, he became one of the most popular manuscript poets of his generation. And at least one reason for the popularity of some of Donne's poetry was his willingness to be bawdy. To quote an excerpt from his not very subtly titled poem, To His Mistress Going to Bed, he writes, "Full nakedness, all joys are due thee. As souls unbodied, bodies unclothed must be to taste whole joys." Although Donne is not someone we would categorize as a proto-feminist by any means, it is fascinating that if we skip to the final two lines of this poem, we find that after almost 400 lines of poetic supplication to his would-be mistress, only the man has ended up naked. It goes like this. "To teach thee, I am naked first. Why then needst thou have more covering than a man?" The poem ends there, so we'll never know if he convinced her or not. Along these lines, some of you may remember the kind of creepy, most famous poem by him, The Flea. Did you have to read this growing up? It's strange. In which he tries to woo another woman with these lines. "Mark but this flea. And mark in this how little that which thou deniest me is. It sucked me first and now sucks thee, and in this flea are two bloods mingled be. Basically, he's saying, well, since the flea has already bitten us both in turn, we might as well consummate the relationship. Personally, I do not find this particular line of poetic argument convincing. Your mileage may vary. Fleas are not my kink, but John Donne, you do you. Although Donne wrote a lot of love poetry, there's also a reason that that let's get metaphysical slogan was emblazoned on that coffee mug. Or why Rundell titled her biography of Donne Super Infinite. She calls Donne an infinity merchant, which gives you a sense of Catherine Rundell can write as well. An infinity merchant because the word is everywhere in his work. He likewise loved to coin formations with the prefix super. Super edifications, super exaltation, super dying, super universal, super miraculous. It was all part of his bid to invent a language that would reach beyond language. Some of you remember Emily Dickinson, tell the truth, but tell it slant, right? You're trying to get at something beyond what prose alone can do. Infinite wasn't enough for Donne, both in heaven, but also here and now on earth. Donne wanted to know something even larger than infinity. He was open to the absurd, to the grandiloquent. He was courageous. He was hungry for more. I want to tell you more about Donne's spiritual side, which dominated the final chapters of his life, but let me get us there by way of a brief tour through his earlier years. Donne was born in London in 1572 into a prominent Roman Catholic family. The prominent part that he had access to a strong homeschooling education in his earliest years and that he was able to enroll at Oxford. This wasn't as unusual at the time, but he enrolled into Oxford University at age 11. The Roman Catholic part of that prominent Roman Catholic family meant that serious religious persecution was going on during that period of English history. At the time, the penalty for being a Catholic priest in England was being hanged, drawn, and quartered, while crowds looked on. And within a few decades on either side of Donne's birth in 1572, 11 members of Donne's family died either in exile or in prison simply for being Catholic. So for a confluence of reasons, sometime in his early 20s, Donne relented to the political pressures of his time and converted to Protestantism. This is a painting of Donne from 1595 when he was 23 years old. Today, we might call him a metrosexual. Throughout his life, he cared a whole lot about clothes and fashion. A few years later in 1601, when he was 29, Donne eloped with, so he was 29, he eloped with the 17-year-old niece of his boss. His powerful boss. His earliest biographer called this choice, quote, the remarkable error of his life. The rest of his life, he was actually pretty cautious in general. Donne was imprisoned for 2 months and almost ended his career at court before it had a chance to really begin. He wrote a 5-word poem about this turn of events. John Donne, and Donne, undone. And for well more than a decade afterwards, his growing family suffered through long periods of serious poverty as he had trouble getting a job that paid well. In 1615, just after he turned 43, this is from 1 year earlier, he was ordained and began to make a name for himself as an Anglican priest. But his fortunes didn't fully turn until 1621, when the 49-year-old Donne was invited to have dinner with King James, who recognized Donne's talents and made him dean of St. Paul's Cathedral. You know that tiny little church? The one with the low ceilings? The one that can't seat that many people? Have you been there? Okay. Quite a few hands. In general, sermons during the Renaissance were long. They were often minimally an hour. They were sometimes as long as 3 hours. Let's just say there wasn't a lot of competition to get back home and watch sports or Netflix. Sermons were often the best way for people to learn breaking news, and functionally, sermons were at the intersection of politics, entertainment, and theater. Congregants often discussed various points of the sermon extensively the following week. Dunn preached his very long sermons without using a text. He used a common oratorical trick some of you may have used as well, called a memory palace. So we would imagine each part of the sermon in turn as a different room in a house he had constructed in his memory. And as he walked in his memory through each new room of the house, it would remind him of what points he wanted to make in each new part of the sermon. His words were said to charm the soul. He often wept in the pulpit in joy and in sorrow, and his audience would weep with him. There were even occasions where something like a modern European football match, people in the crowd were shoved, even trampled from the pressure and excitement. I'll give you just a taste of his religious writings in the form of his Holy Sonnet 14. As you listen, you may notice how his earlier love poetry is now sublimated into spiritual longing for the divine, but the risque edge is still there, you'll notice here. He writes, "Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend. That I may rise and stand, overthrow me, and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like a usurped town to another do, labor to admit you, but oh, to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me should defend, but is captived and proved weak or untrue. Yet dearly, I love you. And would be loved fain, but I am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie and break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free nor ever chaste, except you ravish me." Your standard fare minister at the time was not writing like that. So you can imagine why he inspired large crowds. Now, some of you may be wondering, however, how could so many people possibly hear one person without microphones and speakers and other, modern technology? Dunn scholars had the same question and recently staged a reenactment at St. Paul's Cathedral, recreating as closely as possible what would it have been like centuries ago to hear a Dunn sermon. They discovered that Dunn would have been heard relatively well by the nearest 500 to 1,000 people because of the acoustics of how it was set up. That being said, there are reports of crowds of up to 6,000 to hear his sermon. So what were the other 5,000 doing? Perhaps it was just something to do, a place to see and be seen. Or perhaps key quotes were kind of passed back through the crowd like an ancient game of telephone. For now, let me begin moving toward my conclusion by moving beyond Dunn's favorite themes of love and the superinfinity of metaphysics to the other greatest subject for which he is known, death. One of the most famous examples is Holy Sonnet 10. "Death, be not proud. Some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou think'st thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. For rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, much pleasure, then from thee much more must flow, and soonest our best men with thee do go. Rest of their bones and souls delivery, thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men. And dust with poison, war, and sickness dwell, and poppy or charms can make us sleep as well. And better than thy stroke, why swell'st thou then? One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die." Dunn himself died at home in 1631 at the age of 59, but his legacy lives on. If you visit St. Paul's Cathedral today, you can see a memorial to Dunn. And a little more than a decade ago, a new bust of Dunn was added to the courtyard outside. For now, I'll leave the final words to Dunn himself, likely the most famous words he ever wrote. They resonate deeply with not only the theme of death, but also with our UU seventh principle of the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, as well as our UU sense of responsibility to do what we can do within our spheres of influence to build a better world. It's from Meditation 17, from his book, Devotions Upon Emergent Occasions. No man is an island, entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is less. As well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, for I am involved in mankind, and therefore never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. So as we hold in our heart whatever sense of John Donne's life and legacy may have resonated with you this morning, any sense of maybe reconnecting you with your interest in reconnecting with creativity or art or poetry, I invite you to rise in body or spirit. Let's sing together hymn 108, My Life Flows On in Endless Song.